May it please the court.
You may proceed.
Terrence Anderson lived with his stepfather and his mom and his sister starting from the time he was 10 months old. At the original trial, his stepfather came in and recounted what a wonderful home they had and what a wonderful dad he was. At the retrial, his defense attorneys presented the same information, that his dad was a wonderful dad, and just they had a wonderful home. 2915 court found that at the first trial, the jury heard what an abusive father Terrence's stepfather was, and that was based upon the retrial attorney's testimony that they believed that at the first trial, the jury heard what an abusive situation Terrence Anderson was raised in. That was objectively false. And trial counsel cannot make a reasonable decision, a strategy decision, to forego presenting abuse evidence when the premise is that it was presented at the first trial. And that's what this trial counsel did. They understood, and it was their understanding, and they failed to investigate, and this is a failure to investigate and not be able to make a reasonable strategic decision because they believed that the original trial, the jury heard what an abusive situation Terrence Anderson was in.
There were other reasons they chose to take that approach too, though, right, that showed in the record?
Counsel testified that they didn't like working with Dr. Lewis. She was an inconvenient witness. But even though she's an inconvenient witness, if that was their reason, they needed to find someone else who could have addressed the abuse issues.
Wasn't it also that they wanted somebody who would say they liked him and were on his side, and Robert was the only one who they said had a connection with defendant Still? So if they tore Robert up, and this may have been a failed strategy, and I know you're saying it was the one in the first trial too, but nonetheless, was there some other way they could have gotten a positive witness for their client and address whether that was a reasonable strategy?
Actually, Judge Stith, what they did was they called other family members to testify to the same very identical things that Robert testified to. They called Terrence's mom. They called his half-sister, his stepsister.
So you're saying the record doesn't bear out that claim of a good reason?
No, and they also called his cousin to testify about the identical things that Robert testified to, which was he was an upstanding, always had been an upstanding member of the community, well-liked, well-respected, and how what happened here was just a total, no one can understand why it happened to Terrence. And why it was important to hear about the abusive environment from Dr. Lewis is Dr. Lewis could have explained with the historical abuse that Terrence endured, it would help to provide an explanation for why he reacted in the way he did to the stressful circumstances that he encountered with feeling like he was going to lose his child. And that would have been compelling mitigating evidence that the jury never got to hear. Dr. Lewis had identified things like this spiral tibial fracture, which can only happen from child abuse. She had identified this puncture to his thigh. There was evidence adduced at the first 2915 from both Dr. Cross and also social worker Alfonso about the extensive abuse that Terrence endured. And it was abuse that Terrence himself endured as well as other family members. Terrence himself was battered with these injuries that he had that were identified both by Dr. Lewis and Dr. Pincus from the first trial, and then in the post-conviction action, the first post-conviction action by Dr. Cross and social worker Alfonso. I mean, those kinds of things included not only the fracture and the stabbing wound to his, he had cigarette burns, other scarring to his body that were clearly based upon child abuse, and that's exactly what it was.
Was the stepfather good strategy in the first trial reasonable?
It was not, and trial counsel actually testified. And this is in the first post-conviction action. This was Mr. Moreland. He testified that they didn't present evidence. They had contacted Dr. Cross but not retained him, contacted Ms. Alfonso and had retained her, but they ran out of time to present that evidence. So they didn't realize the extent to which this evidence was available, and that was Mr. Moreland's testimony. And in the first post-conviction action, I briefed a claim about the failure to present a social worker Alfonso's testimony. This court did not reach that issue because it granted penalty phase relief on the juror issue. So that was available. It was right there for counsel on the retrial. They had all of this coming at them. It was readily available to them. It wasn't hidden from them. It's not a reasonable strategy when you have this evidence and believe it was presented at the first trial when it wasn't.
But wasn't there other witnesses that failed to confirm that this abuse, the sister, the mother, and others failed to substantiate this?
Judge Powell, there was a non-reporting of it, and that's how I would cast it as. But in terms of non-reporting, there's also evidence at this 2915 that is consistent with people who are abused because they're fearful of further abuse to them, their other loved ones in that environment. And the mitigation specialist from this trial team testified that she had those kinds of things disclosed to her that people like Terrence's stepsister Deborah disclosed to her and Robert's ex-wife, Earlene, all this abuse, and they were fearful to disclose this kind of thing because they knew they would be in for more battering of themselves, of other family members.
I guess where I'm going with this is that, you know, isn't it reasonable trial strategy, though, to say, man, we're worried that the jury and everyone's not going to believe that he was abused and he's making all this up when he's talking to these counselors?
No, I mean, it's not. This was independently identified by people like Dr. Lewis. The spiral fracture, it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen by what Robert reported was getting hit by a car. It's intentional twisting action. He had the puncture wound, Terrence did, to his thigh, which Dr. Lewis identified and Dr. Pincus identified. There are also the identification of the cigarette burns to Terrence that he and other scarring on his body. So confronted with the actual substantive abuse to Terrence himself, I don't see how a reasonable juror, could step back and say, this didn't happen because you have objective medical evidence.
Was there anything tying it to Robert, especially if he didn't testify?
It was tied to Robert based upon the conclusions of things like what Earlene had told, had reported to Dr. Lewis. It was based upon Dr. Lewis testified that Terrence was not forthcoming about the abuse, but then her testimony was, well, why did you have to step in between your parents to prevent violence from happening? Mm-hmm. So Terrence actually did report it. He wasn't directly reporting it. He was downplaying it because he knew, he feared for himself and his mom and his sister that there would be more. So actually it came from Terrence in his own reporting. It was just downplayed. And Dr. Lewis's response was, well, if you're having to step in between your parents, isn't there some violence going on? And Terrence at one point said, you know what, I can't be disclosing these things. There's things about my family that I can't tell. And while he may not have been forthcoming with it, in the Rompilla case, we actually had, in the U.S. Supreme Court, had a defendant who was actually affirmatively obstructive to the evidence. And I think we have to take into account this is child abuse, and it's abuse in which everyone is being victimized, and everyone feels like, I'm going to be victimized more if I'm forthcoming with this information. And I think that's the context in which this has to be viewed. But ultimately, it comes back to trial counsel believed that this was presented at the first trial when, in fact, it objectively wasn't, and the motion court found it was, and that was based upon counsel's testimony. And counsel can't make a reasonable strategic decision when the premise of that decision was that it was presented at the first trial is objectively wrong, even with the motion court's finding, and it was based upon counsel's testimony.
Does it matter where it was presented, or does it matter only that counsel was familiar with the availability of that evidence?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
You say it wasn't in the first trial, but it was all over the first PCR hearing.
Well, so, it wasn't presented at the first trial because the psychological witnesses were strictly called in guilt for diminished capacity. But some of that evidence was available, and Dr. Lewis had identified it, but she wasn't called for that reason. And it wasn't presented at the first trial by first trial counsel's own admission that they just didn't get to it. And they had actually retained the people who testified about it in the first PCR.
Right. But it was in the first PCR.
It was in the first PCR.
So second trial counsel plainly aware that all of that evidence was available, right? And is that what matters? Or or does it matter that it wasn't used in the first trial? I'm not sure I understand why that matters.
I think what matters is trial counsel thought that it got presented at the original trial when it didn't. That was their
problem. So what? That's what I'm not clear about.
That's the premise of their decision not to go forward and present it.
You're saying it wasn't reasonable to choose to do something different than the first trial when you'd done no reasonable investigation as to what occurred in the first trial and you ended up just replicating what occurred in the first trial.
That states it better than I can state it, that they just replicated the first trial because they hadn't investigated. That's exactly what they did. They replicated what took place.
That they hadn't investigated what?
Whether or not the violence evidence about Robert was presented at the first trial, they didn't investigate.
Right. But they were aware of that evidence. This isn't a normal claim where they didn't do an investigation and therefore didn't know that the evidence was available. They knew the evidence was, they just didn't want to use it.
No, I don't think that's true at all. They actually were putting it off on, well, you know, there were these things where Terrence wasn't forthcoming with it, so we're not going to, Terrence and his mom were not forthcoming. Was their reason for not presenting it?
Your claim that they hadn't investigated was they did not sufficiently review what happened in the first trials. It wasn't that they hadn't investigated the abuse claim. It's they didn't investigate what the record was in the first trial. Is that what?
That's precisely correct, Your Honor. That is exactly what they didn't review the records that preceded them as to what was and was not done. And that's exactly where they failed to investigate and failed to prepare, so they couldn't make a reasonable strategic decision.
Are there cases that address that issue, the insufficient investigation in that context,
I think the Porta case, which is discussed in my brief, deals with that. It's a failure to basically be cognizant of the facts that have gone on and to fail to present the ones that are compelling for your client. And the Porter is discussed in my brief, but there's also cases like Wiggins and Williams, and Ron Pillar is discussed in my brief as well.
My fear is that you're taking us to a place where, on retrial, you've got to change what you did at the first trial, or you're going to be at risk, if not certain, of being found to have been incompetent.
Judge, I don't think it's objectively reasonable at a retrial now for any counsel to put on that Robert was a good father. Now, whether you choose, and I think they thought...
But it was reasonable in the first trial.
No, it wasn't, because counsel from that first trial, and I refer you to my briefs that I briefed in the first, they testified, we didn't get to it. We ran out of time. That was their testimony. That's Mr. Moreland's testimony. It was done by deposition for purposes of the first trial, that we had contacted Dr. Cross and we had contacted Ms. Alfonso. But you know what? And his language was, we ran out of time. And that's why they didn't present it.
That's a valid point, and I'll look at the old briefs. But just assume for purposes of this question that it was reasonable in the first trial. Does it become unreasonable in the second trial because the first trial didn't work?
I'm not sure what you're saying was reasonable at the first trial.
The decision to go with good stepfather.
I don't think you ever want to tell a jury something that's objectively false. And the evidence about Robert is objectively false. Why would you want any jury to believe?
Well, the evidence was not that he was a great stepfather. The evidence was that he felt that the defendant was incapable of the crime, right? That he had an ongoing good relationship.
Actually, the focus of Robert's evidence has always been about what a great dad he was. He took him, you know, he went to all his basketball games and really...
But that wasn't the purpose for which he was offered in the first trial.
It really was. That was what was why he was called to the first and the retrial.
All right. To get to my point, say it's a self-defense. Say it's whatever the defense is that's reasonable in the first trial. And the first trial has to be done over again, although it ended in a guilty verdict. How can you use the same tactic that failed in the first trial in the second trial without you coming and saying that that's by definition incompetent?
I think you're extrapolating too much here. I think it would be unreasonable to call Robert to again testify what a great dad he was and what an awesome family environment they had growing up. I mean, I think counsel on another on a retrial would have to evaluate the abuse evidence, but it's overwhelming abuse here. You don't get a spiral tibial fracture unless it's physical abuse. You don't get the puncture wound that Terrence had. You don't get the scarring that he has or the cigarette burns on his body. I mean,
I think Judge Wilson is asking, in a hypothetical case, not in this case, is it always unreasonable trial strategy to present evidence or a defense theory in the second trial or a mitigation theory in the second trial that was unsuccessful in the first trial?
Is it always, would it always be ineffectiveness? Is that what you're asking, to present the same one?
I think that was Judge Wilson's question. Is it always ineffective if you presented evidence in the first trial and the jury reached a negative verdict?
To represent the same evidence, I'm not saying it would always be, but I think here, because the jury got an objectively false presentation, I think this is like the Gill case. The jury was left with an objectively false presentation.
Isn't it a more narrow issue that trial counsel in the second trial developed their trial strategy without making sufficient effort to know what occurred in the first trial so that they could effectively evaluate whether or not that evidence should be presented in the second trial?
That's exactly what happened, is they did not effectively evaluate what had preceded them in time, both as to the original trial with Dr. Lewis and the first post-conviction action, as to all this abuse evidence, the actual physical abuse that Terrence Anderson himself sustained. So that is exactly right, Your Honor. Yes.
You're out of time.
May it please the court. I'm going to start with this concept of that they decided to do something different, but it turned out to be the same argument. First of all, Counsel Turlington never testified that what happened at the first trial was the basis of the decision at the second trial. Only one of the two attorneys testified to that. She mentioned it maybe once or twice in her most recent testimony, and as we argue in the brief, we believe she qualified that statement as to her memory. As the court has already pointed out this morning, that counsel may have a hard time keeping track of what happened in what proceeding at the time they're testifying at an evidentiary hearing years later.
So what other reason was there? If there were other witnesses to testify positively about him, why not put on this evidence, which U.S. Supreme Court cases have recognized can make a difference to juries?
It can make a difference. And counsel both testified, we considered it. This was a defense we were willing to consider. It's a defense we were willing to put on if we connect it. There's two answers to that question. The first answer is that special counsel Turlington, I remember, talked about like the emotional investment that Robert had versus the other family witnesses. They got on the stand to testify, but he said, but Robert was the only person who was still emotionally involved in the case, the only person who was still showing a real emotional attachment to the defendant. And when we're here looking at a cold record and trying to assess whether counsel is reasonable, we don't have to consider things like demeanor and how witnesses are going to come off and whether warmth is going to be shown in those things. But that's something that actual trial attorneys in the actual process of trial have to consider. And Counsel Turlington testified without any contrary evidence that, no, Robert was really the only person still engaged in that extent. But second, the bigger reason here as to this whole issue about what's different is we don't believe that even that Carrie Davis was even, or Davis Carrie, I can never remember which way to keep her name. I think it was Davis once upon a time. The reason that what she was talking about is we want to do something different was, here's what she was talking about. She's like, the last trial we had mental health experts testify in the first trial, including Dr. Lewis testified at the first trial. An appellant was still convicted at the first trial. An appellant still got a death sentence. Now, granted, it wasn't on this issue specifically, but her credibility had already been tested once before before a jury that still sentenced him to death. So what she's saying is what we want to do is we want to streamline our mental health expert to one expert. And Dr. Holcomb reviewed Dr. Lewis's stuff And so we're going to call Dr. Holcomb, and then we want appellant to testify. And that's clearly different from the first trial in which appellant doesn't. We want appellant to demonstrate the anguish that he was feeling. You know, that, and appellant, what appellant argued was the entire purpose of trying to call Dr. Lewis is to try to go from I was abused to, and that's why I had anguish about being separated from my child. Well, here they were going. Well, we're going to put appellant on the stand to testify why he was scared that he was being separated from child in his anguish. What Robert was called to testify to was not to establish that he was a great father. And I understandably, appellant's going to read his testimony as uncharitably as possible. But this court's going to read the evidence in the light most favorable to the motion court's conclusions. And in that light is he was called to establish that this act was tremendously out of character for appellant. That appellant was he was a good kid. He was an athlete on Poplar Bluff sports teams. If I think I fairly say those are good sports teams. He volunteered his church and dressed up as the Easter Bunny when no other teenager in the church would want to do something like that, but he did it. He was a good kid. This was so out of character for him. And his father was the one family witness that they had that was able to effectively, engagingly present this evidence. That's what counsel said. And there comes a point where we defer to counsel. We presume that counsel had a reasonable trial strategy because those are the kind of decisions that counsel has to make.
Was similar testimony offered by the other witnesses defense counsel mentioned?
I don't know that quantitatively it was, and two, I don't know if qualitatively it was, that it was the same. They were background witnesses about, yeah, he was, so sure, there was a good kid. Again, we can't take counsel away from the reality of it is, look, we have this guy. He's a respected member of the community. He's a member of the city council. He's a good witness for us. Now we have this evidence from which we may be able to get an expert to reach a conclusion that the jury might buy that Robert was the person who abused him. Was there abuse? Probably. We'd say the radial fracture is kind of compelling argument. Did Robert cause it? We don't know the answer to that. And that's the other half of the equation here is that appellant, not just appellant's family members, but appellant himself told counsel it didn't happen. He didn't do it to me. And counsel is entitled to rely on his client's statements about what the evidence
is. And is the jury ever going to hear that abuse evidence if the defendant doesn't offer it?
No.
Is the state going to come in and put in all that evidence to impeach in some fashion, I guess, the stepfather?
No. I have yet to really see a case in these contexts where somebody gets on and is like, he was a good kid, and what we're going to do is now we're going to destroy your credibility. Because essentially as impeachment, I can't imagine how any of that testimony would be relevant for impeachment as it's just like unrelated bad acts of witness. So no, it's only going to come in if counsel decides they want to elicit it and if a witness is testifying to it. And counsel chose not to testify because here, not only did appellant and his sister say the abuse didn't happen, but appellant and sister all said, and Dr. Lewis is lying about things that she claimed in these reports. We didn't say those things to her. So here counsel has an expert witness who has demonstrated in past cases with the public defender to be not all that compelling a witness. That was one of the things that the counsel Davids could carry. Appellant claims that, well, the evidence doesn't show that she was lying, but she said, oh, I didn't receive those things, and then they said, no, you signed for them. She goes, oh, well, I actually do have them. That's not a lie, that's a mistake. Well, it's a lie or a mistake, and we're going to look at the facts in the light most favorable of the motion court's ruling. She did not have a good grasp of the facts, and she was misrepresenting counsel's clients. So we have all these other factors that Dr. Lewis, in relying on these hearsay statements from over time about the abuse, was the only person who was going to say, and Robert abused appellant. Because appellant wasn't going to say it, and appellant's sister wasn't going to say it, and appellant's mother was going to say it. To be honest, appellant doesn't say that anybody else witnessed it. Instead, what appellant relies on is, well, he suffered some injuries, so Robert must have caused them. Or, well, Robert was angry, or Robert was abusive to his ex-wife, so Robert must have done it. And so, first of all, you have to convince the jury that abuse happened. Probably. You probably can establish that. Second, you have to establish Robert did it, even though appellant denies it, even though the sister denies it, even though the mother denies it. You then have to establish three. And because, and the abuse was so pervasive that it had an effect on him, which then, four, is, and that was the compelling reason as to why he committed this murder. And five, and for that reason, we have to find that death isn't appropriate here. Counsel can look at that and go, wow, that is a lot of hurdles to jump over. All of any one of those hurdles that
what,
were
what about the U.S. Supreme Court case, and I'm sure you know the name and I can't recall, which said that failure to investigate for such abuse required them to remand it for a new trial because, right. In fact, the jury needed to hear that and it was ineffective not to
And counsel investigated it. Uh-huh. And that's why, I believe this court says, but at least all the appellate courts say it, a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel after investigation of an issue for a reason of trial strategy is virtually unchallengeable. They have the information. Appellant doesn't point out any information. Instead, today what he's saying, well, they didn't read the first trial transcript, and we don't really know that that's what happened. Ms. Carey might have just been mistaken by the time she got to the PCR years after the trial, and they didn't actually believe that at the trial time, especially since Ms. Turlington never testified that they had a mistaken understanding of what happened at the first trial. There was a radical difference in the trial strategy, which is what we believe Ms. Davis-Carey was talking about, and that is the difference between having appellant testify and not having appellant testify. Counsel had all the information. There isn't any information about Robert that they didn't have. That's what separates it out from Rompilla and Williams. And the whole five lists is just like one after the other, all findings. They were failure to investigate cases, and that is not what we have here. So, appellant's basically saying, with all the information before you, you were required to choose that trial strategy instead of this trial strategy. Counsel looked at that trial strategy and say, there are lots of problems with us presenting it. We don't have witnesses who are willing to explicitly tie the abuse to Robert. We don't have a witness we believe is effectively going to be able to communicate the love and warmth that somebody still has, as well as Robert. We have Robert as a respected voice in the community and may be a more compelling witnesses than other family members were. We have an expert witness who we frankly, and this was Ms. Davis-Carey's words, we don't really know what's going to come out of her mouth once she gets up on the stand because of all the problems we've had in her, and that she seems to be more concerned with being credible on radio and TV than she does to be in a courtroom. When you put all these factors together, and that Dr. Lewis was the only person who could do it, and Dr. Lewis, you know, in the example that even appellant's given here today, Dr. Lewis is trying to convince appellant that he was actually abused instead of accepting appellant's statements as was. Basically, appellant says, counsel can only be reasonable by making all of those decisions instead of making decisions that we made. We don't second-guess counsel because it didn't work. We don't look at the facts only in the light most favorable to appellant's claims instead of looking at the in the light most favorable to the trial court, to the motion court's ruling. These were reasonable choices counsel made, faced with difficult circumstances, not the least of which was appellant tells them during trial, "Oh, no, by the way, I've been lying to the doctors the entire time." Counsel evaluated the evidence, knowing all of the evidence that appellant claimed should have pressed today. Counsel made the decision that they made. They wanted appellant to testify and one expert. They didn't want this evidence about Robert's abuse. Instead, wanted to use Robert to help not paint Robert in a good light, but to paint appellant in a good light. That's a reasonable trial strategy. They wanted remorse. They wanted to show an act out of character, and that's what they did. It didn't work, but we don't fault counsel because something didn't work. We only fault them if it was constitutionally unreasonable, if they essentially were not acting as an attorney anymore in decisions that they make. This is not that case. We'd ask you to affirm.
The state wants this court to defer to the 2915 findings. The 2915 court found, based upon counsel's testimony, that the evidence that Robert was an abuser and a batterer was presented at the first trial. That came from defense counsel. This court should defer to that because that was their testimony. The state wants to present it as they did not testify in that fashion, but that was the finding of the 2915 court. And this court should go with what 2915 counsel testified to, that this evidence, what they believe this evidence was presented at the first trial. The state also says that no one expressly found that these physical assaults on Terrence were done by Robert. Both Dr. Cross and Ms. Alfonso in the first 2915 provided testimony to that effect, that Robert was the one responsible. And Dr. Lewis concluded he was responsible because of the nature of the physical harms. In fact, Ms. Alfonso testified that Robert is a batterer who rules by intimidation. And that goes to why there was not this forthcoming and reluctance to be forthcoming, but even Dr. Lewis identified through Terrence's own reporting to her, why are you having to step in between these people if there's no violence going on in the home? There is no evidence that Dr. Lewis lied anywhere. That is just totally not true what the state has represented to this court. Dr. Lewis lied. I've set that forth in my reply brief, and I would refer to her testimony. And if you look at what counsel testified to, yeah, counsel didn't like working with Dr. Lewis, but counsel also testified, and this is Ms. Carey, at the outset she had an inward groan and thought, oh great, we got to work with Dr. Lewis. That was Ms. Carey's testimony. And that's why Dr. Lewis was not worked with, to develop and present to this jury what was wrong, most fundamentally wrong, with Robert battering and abusing Terrence Anderson. That's why this jury didn't hear, because counsel wasn't aware that it didn't get presented at the first trial. The state says,
if there hadn't been a first trial, what would be left of your claim?
I'm sorry?
If these lawyers, knowing what they knew, had tried the second trial the way they tried it, and the first trial hadn't happened, what would be left of your claim?
They should have presented this evidence at the retrial.
Okay, but why wasn't it a reasonable trial strategy in the second trial not to?
You don't get to reasonable trial strategy because they didn't know. They believed at the first trial it was presented.
No, there is no first trial in my hypothetical. It just got tried once.
Well, okay. That's not the facts that we're dealing with.
I understand that. That's why I call it a hypothetical. If there had only been tried once by these lawyers, knowing everything they knew, and they tried it the way they tried it, would you have a claim?
Yes, because you don't present to a jury that Robert is a loving, caring dad when he's a batterer. You don't want any jury to hear something objectively false. Just like
how would they know it's objectively false?
Because we had people like Dr. Cross, Ms. Alfonso, and Dr. Lewis concluding he was the source.
Who would put that evidence on?
Dr. Lewis did, because she reviewed all of this.
She doesn't get to testify. She didn't run into the courtroom and shout it out loud. Who tells the jury that that's her opinion?
She gets to tell
the defendants it. Would have to do that, correct?
No.
You think the state puts that evidence on?
No, the state doesn't put it on. They call Dr. Lewis as an expert witness to testify about
In the first trial? When did they call Dr. She didn't test. Never mind. Go ahead.
They would call Dr. Lewis to testify about all this abuse evidence that is supported by Dr. Cross, Ms. Alfonso, Dr. Pincus. So she would testify about all of that, and she came to those conclusions. She also reviewed Robert's police records.
You're saying it was, in my hypothetical, where the case is only tried once by these lawyers knowing everything they knew, that it was incompetent because the jury would know he was a batterer. And I'm asking you, how would they know that unless it was the defendants who told them that, who put on that evidence?
Are you saying that the defendant has to testify?
No, I'm saying how would they know that it was objectively false, he was a good guy? How would they know he was a batterer unless that was an inference they drew from evidence the defendants put on?
Well, you would want to put on that evidence. I mean, they call Robert, who has convictions for forgery and also bad check writing. This is a guy who's not a credible witness, but they gave him credence. That's what the defense attorneys did. Why would you do that when you have all these expert witnesses telling you he's the batterer in the family, and this is a guy with convictions for forgery and bad check writing?
So you're saying it's inherently unreasonable to choose to present him in a good light for the reasons they gave, that they thought it would show that Terrence came from a good family and this was aberrational for him to act this way?
They had all the witnesses testify to the same thing. From family and non-family members.
And opposing counsel says it was different. I take it you'd disagree.
Robert's testimony and the other family testimony was the same. And then they called other people like Terrence's coaches.
Did the lawyers think it was different? You might think it was the same, but did the lawyers testify that they thought there was a different character or nature to his testimony than the mothers or the sisters?
They said that they wanted to present something different, and they were doing the same thing. They didn't testify about...
Did they say Robert offered something the other witnesses didn't offer? Was that one of their reasons why they took the approach they took?
They thought Robert could bring something to it by presenting an objectively false presentation of himself, but his testimony was the same as the other witnesses that they called. It was no different. It was identical to what they heard from the other witnesses. And
so that was an unreasonable belief on their part?
It certainly was, because they did not. Robert added nothing to what was, you know, what was these other witnesses. I really believe this court's case in Gill is really compelling from the standpoint of here, what took place here. Because in Gill, the jury thought the defendant was more deserving of death because the victim was such a wonderful person, and we found out that he wasn't. Here the jury was told Terrence was more deserving of death because he came from a family and he abandoned that good upbringing, and the prosecutor argued that and hammered that in closing argument, that Terrence abandoned this good family that he had to do what he did here, and he had this good upbringing and abandoned, and that was the prosecutor's closing argument, what the jury heard at the very end, and that was the last thing they heard. I see that I'm out of time.
You
Unless
are
the court
time.
Has questions, I'd be happy to address any questions the court has.
Thank you,
Your Honor. I ask that you reverse this case.
It's a well-argued case.